No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it, said a voice from the crowd.
Well, hello, everybody. Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we, the people, are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In our first hour, we have Yuri Rashkin with the Fenn Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup to talk about the weekly news. And I will have Kathleen Falk on to talk about her gubernatorial campaign. Then the capper, Chris Liebenthal, will be joining us to discuss the updates on the John Doe investigation, followed by Liz D. Novella will finish out the hour. She's one of the editors of the Progressive Magazine, and will talk about her visit to CPAC. We apologize for some technical difficulties this morning. Sarah is here but attempting to get on, and hopefully all of you can hear me. Continuing on with what we have today for our show, we will continue to talk with Liz about CPAC in the second hour and have Wisconsin speakers Governor Walker, U.S. Rep. Paul Ryan, and Senator Glenn Grothman, of which she will be talking about. After Liz, Scott Witkoff, the blogger from Badger Democracy, will be on to talk about this week's news stories and the progressive movement. We will finish off the show with Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin. She will be talking about the wetlands bill that was passed Wednesday after midnight. So, if you're looking to call in, please call at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Also, we will have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions. And a quick announcement, we are very excited to announce that the Sarah Schultz Show can now be heard on Sundays at 8 a.m. on WFAQ 92.9 LPFM in Mukwonago, Waukesha. So, without further ado, we will get to our first guest, Mr. Yuri Rashkin. Yuri, welcome. Thank you for holding. And how are things with you, sir?
Oh, things are good, Bill. Glad that we're on the air. You know, it's an encouraging development. You never know where things can go from here.
Yes.
So, we've got lots of things happening. I suppose, for starters, we should acknowledge a few anniversaries that we're staring right in the face. First of all, that we have just marked anniversary of Scott Walker's assault on democracy as the Progressive Magazine puts it. It's been a year since Scott Walker dropped the bomb, so to say, and using his terms, and the state has not been the same since then. And today we're actually looking at an anniversary of the fabulous 14 that have left the state a year ago. And what an interesting year it's been for our state senators, where you have a total division of the state in terms of how they look at it. We have half the state that is looking at the Fab 14 as the heroes, and Fab 14 and half the state, or you know, whatever the other half of the state, that's looking at this group as people who walked off the job or escaped, or I don't even know what it is, but we have 14 people that I think did absolutely the right thing, that some of them are now looking at potentially being involved in a governor race and in the recall. And what is the strongest downside for their candidacies? It's the fact that they're members of Fab 14. So the thing that can be your strongest asset can be your biggest weakness. Isn't that funny how that works?
It is. It's good to hear.
So so we have the anniversary of that. And then the major... Well, and then, of course, I wanted to congratulate Sarah. I don't know if we will be able to get to speak to her today, but just, I wanted to let her know that, you know, everybody knows that she won election to the position of village trustee for the village.
That's great, isn't it? Sarah, yeah. By the way, everybody, Sarah can hear us. She just can't talk due to some of the technical difficulties, but we're going to try and continue to get her on. So you will have to bear along with me. And Yuri, just getting, I'm amazed that you're talking about the Fab 14 and where we are just 1 year ago. It's amazing where we've come in this 1 year.
Yes, Yes. I was thinking, you know, with Sarah being able to hear us but not being able to say anything, this is like the ultimate payback to a talk show host, where you can tell anything you want to say about them and they can't respond. This is like the ultimate nightmare. So if there's anything you wanted to say about Sarah and didn't think that you wanted to, her to talk back at you, here's your chance, everybody. Call it. So, but it's great. I'm really thrilled to see her win, and it sounds like she won in a pretty dramatic fashion, and it's really nice to see good people getting involved in public service. So I am always encouraging people to think about running for a local government office, and so Sarah did it, and if anybody's out there listening thinks that they couldn't do it, I bet they could.
So, yeah, I'll just comment, if you don't mind, I'll just comment real quick on that. That I was at a county activity and talking about bike trail development, tourism, and using tourism as an inexpensive way to use it as a tool for economic development. And one of the biggest complaints that most people had in the audience was that local officials who pretty much who have been previously elected to either be obstacles or to vote no on everything certainly serve as a major obstacle in moving simple things like developing bike trails forward, because no one wants to spend a nickel on anything. But I will tell you what they all do want. Any free money from the state or federal government, they will certainly gobble up and then take credit for.
Well, this is a pretty classic situation that I find over and over, where everybody likes government programs that benefits them. And anything that costs them money, well, we're all opposed to that. And it's just a kind of always challenge of trying to think bigger and thinking a little bit beyond ourselves. But that's why you've got to have people who have a bigger vision everywhere, not just in federal, not just president, but you've got to have those people who can think bigger on your village boards and city councils and school boards. There's big things at stake, and so much is done on the local level.
Hey, guys. It's me. I can finally hear everyone. I'm back. Well, Yuri, I've got to kind of cut you off here. I'm so sorry to do that, but we've got Kathleen Falk on. We have a very little time with her, so I'm going to say thank you so much. Thank you for holding on with the technical difficulties. I had all sorts of problems on my end. So we'll get you on a little longer next week to make up for it, I promise.
Oh, there's much to talk about, so you have fun.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You have a good day, Yuri.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. And up next will be Kathleen Falk.
Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the quid pro quo with WEAC, the teachers union? Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the other gubernatorial candidates that are now lining up to run against Governor Walker, who stood at the podium and cut a deal with them? The mayor of Milwaukee now saying, listen, I can't really line that up right now. And other members, even of this body, who have been talking about this all week, about the blurry line that exists between the Democratic Party of Wisconsin and its members and the public employee unions. Is that what this is about, Kathleen Falk? Kathleen Falk, who cut some deal, a gubernatorial candidate with $24,000 in her account, and yet is standing at the podium embracing Mary Bell, hugging, literally standing arm in arm. Is that what you're talking about? Is that what this discussion is about today in the Senate, about Kathleen Falk and the corruption that now exists between the unions and your gubernatorial candidate? Because if it is, I'd love to talk about that. We'll talk about it all day if you want.
I'd like to welcome the now very famous Kathleen Falk to the Sarah Schultz Show.
Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm chuckling. It sounds like they're worried about us, doesn't it?
It does. If he had to bring it up. And the funny thing is, I'll play the before part of it. You weren't even mentioned. Senator Hansen was talking about the anniversary and about how the state's going the wrong direction, and Scott Fitzgerald comes up with you. So,
well, I guess they're afraid. I guess that's good. I'm ready to have an election. Are you?
I am more than ready to have an election. We are sliding backwards very quickly here, and it'd be really great to get the state back on track. Well, how are you going to battle the personality attacks by the Fitz brothers and the Republican Party? Obviously, you just heard one right there.
I'm strong. You know, I am doing this because I am inspired by not only the million people who did this historic, brave step of the most basic demonstration of democracy possible to reclaim their state, but I'm inspired every day. I have been out there the whole past year, every day, a wonderful citizen who just pours out their heart to me and says, this isn't right. Governor Walker is wrong. It isn't working. We can't trust him. We expect better. We can get better. And that inspires me. So I will stand up to these personal attacks. I will fight for working men and women and get our state back. And I am proud to do so.
Well, do you feel that the Walker agenda, speaking of fighting and putting people against each other, Walker agenda is pitting Madison against the rest of the state by vilifying the residents of Madison and Dane County? And, well, you know, I'm going to hold on a second because I think we just lost Kathleen. I'm not sure where she was, but she dropped out. So as soon as she gets back, we will go right to her. In the meantime, I am going to play a progressive point of view, and hopefully she'll come right back with us. We can finish talking.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. If the honchos in the Republican Party want to make the next election about who's in favor of contraception and who's not, go to it, fellas. Have a ball. The Republican presidential candidates have already tried to make an issue out of President Obama's sensible position that women ought to be able to have their contraceptives covered by either their employer or their insurance company. Rick Santorum thinks this is an outrage. He would. As Bill Maher said, he believes life begins at erection. And Santorum says states can outlaw contraception. He'll have state troopers coming into your medicine cabinet before he's through. And this morning, Republicans in the House held a hearing on contraception with four witnesses, all of them right-wing men. The Republican committee chairman refused to hear from the one woman who wanted to testify. So House Democrats, to their credit, decided to walk out in protest. Republicans are way, way behind the times on this one. The American public, by a 66-26% margin, favor Obama's position. But male Republican politicians have such nostalgia for an era of blatant male domination that they're willing to risk it all to return to that day. But it just won't fly. Not in the year 2012. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Well, when it rains, it pours. Things just don't always work right, and unfortunately, when one thing happens, it seems to always snowball. So we have Kathleen Falk back. Welcome back.
Great. And Sarah, I hope the rest of your day goes better.
Well, you know, it's you never know how good you have until you have days like this. You go, oh, that's right. I have nothing to complain about and ever. Now, I'm going to get back to the question. You were talking about standing up and fighting against some of these attacks. And Walker tends to like to pit Madison against the rest of the state. And he's really vilifying the residents of Madison and Dane County. Do you think that will form some sort of boycott there where people just don't want to come to Madison, and will it adversely affect the businesses that are in Madison?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And, you know, what's wrong with Walker and his administration and his allies is they've always got to find a demon. They've always got to blame things on somebody. And that's just not what people in Wisconsin want. Last night I was in where I grew up, Waukesha, talking with a wonderful group of people. And this one gentleman stands up and says, I'm just so sad. He said, I'm just so sad because my family members won't even talk to each other anymore. Walker has just torn us apart. In times when it's tough and we're losing jobs and people are losing their health care and they're rolling back the environmental laws and they're making it harder to vote in this anti-choice, women's choice agenda, we need to be coming together. And that inspires me. It's what we need leaders to do. It's why I'm eager to lead from day one. And I know this election will be sooner than some people realize. And so we've got to be organized and working, and that's what we need to do, come together and defeat Scott Walker.
Well, how do you plan on bringing the state back together? If you're governor, you hopefully whoever goes against him is going to beat him, and hopefully it will be you. But how are you going to bring the state back together with the animosity that he has created?
Well, here's one example, but it's real. What I have told people is that I will, the day after the election, I will go to Waukesha County. Now, I was born in Milwaukee and then grew up in Big Bend, which is a very small, wonderful place on the Fox River in southern Waukesha County. And then later on, we moved into the city of Waukesha, where I spent the rest of my years growing up. And I know that now the politics in Waukesha County are about 2-1 Republican-Democrat, right? It's about 2-1. So I will go to Waukesha County, where I grew up, but knowing what the politics are, purposely to start that healing process. And by healing, I mean people talking to each other and working together on issues. I don't mean wishy-washy on what we have to do to undo the Walker agenda. That's why I have been out there saying, for whoever has asked me over the many months, how will you restore collective bargaining, Kathleen? How we have to do it? We only have one way to do it. A governor doesn't have the power to do it by executive order. A governor can ask the legislature to convene in a special session, but the legislature doesn't have to. And we know the Assembly Republicans are not going to want to convene in a special session to undo the repeal of collective bargaining. And so the only vehicle a governor has is through a budget bill. That's why Governor Walker eliminated workers' rights through a budget bill. And what I've said is I will restore them that way. I will put them in a budget bill to restore them, and I'm willing to veto a budget bill if it doesn't have it in. Because unless you are strong in standing up for these rights, we will not get them back. So how we talk to people is important for bringing people together. But undoing the Walker agenda is what our task is to do, and I am eager to do that work.
Well, the Republicans, and you heard with Scott Fitzgerald and his rant, are trying to tie union and you together, and obviously they're making unions sound horrible when Scott Walker calls them the big government union bossage. How are you going to be able to offset that? How are you going to be able to say, you know, to fight that?
Because I, like most of us, I think, in Wisconsin, I don't have friends who are Texas billionaires and Missouri millionaires and Florida millionaires like Governor Walker is doing, crisscrossing the country, raising these unforeseen amounts of money for his campaign war chest. I just grew up in Milwaukee and Waukesha, and I'm the granddaughter of a bus driver. And I learned early on that no one of us has much power, but by watching over each other and for each other, we collectively do. So when my grandfather, you know, organized and worked and get collective bargaining rights for his generation, it made my life better. It built a middle class. It gave me a safe workplace. It gave me a 40-hour week. It gave me a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. It gave me some confidence that I would not be discriminated against in my workplace. And reminding all of us in Wisconsin about why we have what we have now is because the generation before us worked hard to give us these rights. And that's how I believe we counter the disrespect that so many are giving to hardworking men and women.
How do you think that's going to play in the northern rural areas? How do you think you are actually going to do in northern rural areas? Because, again, it's that same, it's that Madison, Milwaukee versus the rest of the state message.
Well, I love all of Wisconsin, and that sounds silly and trite, but let me tell you why and how real this is. But first let me give you the kind of the numbers and then the values and my emotions underneath that. But, you know, we in Wisconsin elect people from Dane County regularly. We elected fabulous Russ Feingold 3 times over. We elected Jim Doyle 5 times over statewide. So we regularly in our state elect Dane County people. And when I ran 6 years ago, I got 1,056,000 votes, which is 50,000 more votes than the Democrat running for governor got a year and a half ago. So I have proven I can get votes statewide, and the reason why I think is getting to the why I love all of Wisconsin. I was born in Milwaukee, grew up in Waukesha County, but then I went to law school in order to be an environmental lawyer when this was unheard of in the 1970s. And I then spent the next 20 years helping people in every corner of the state protect their favorite backyard place. And so as I am out and about this past year, and you know, I went to Ashland about 3 weeks ago after I announced I was running for governor, and I can walk into the Black Cat Cafe where there's 35 people waiting on a 13 below zero morning to talk with me. And about a 10 or so of them know me already because I helped them protect the Fish Creek Slough 20 years earlier. And so I love every corner of the state because I love the outdoors and I love the people. And why I think we are so much the same everywhere. There's some differences, of course. But fundamentally, in Wisconsin, we don't ask for much. We want good schools for our kids, some decent health care when we need it, clean air and water, and a decent paying job. Those are our shared values. We don't ask for much. And those certainly aren't the values that Scott Walker has delivered for our state over the last year with this far-right radical National Tea Party agenda that aren't Wisconsin values.
Well, I know you have to go. Do you have time for one more question?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I would like to know, as a environmental lawyer, what is your stance on the mining bill and the wetland bill that they just passed, and what could you do as governor? What would be one of the things that you would do to help fix that if the mining bill also passed?
Well, what an incredible timely example of your question just this week when look at the pains that the Senate Republicans had to go through to try to weaken these laws. You know, disbanding a Senate committee because they didn't agree with the results and having votes at 12:01 in the morning. I thought these were the Republicans that a year and a half ago said no more of that nonsense of voting at midnight. But here they are. And it seems to me they do those kinds of behaviors because they do know what they are doing does not represent what 5.5 million people want for our state. And here is my record on mining. You know, as I said, I started out as an environmental lawyer in the late 70s, and that was a time when the mining companies were discovering these new bodies of ore in northern Wisconsin. And the legislature then said, well, we ought to look at our mining laws to see if they are adequate for a new generation of mining. And so legislators created some changes to the laws then in the late 1970s and early 1980s and modernized the mining laws. The first company then to come into Wisconsin was Kennecott up in northwestern Wisconsin in Rusk County along the Flambeau River. And I was then one of the two public interveners, which was the environmental watchdog for the state created by Governor Knowles a quarter of a century earlier. And it was the office was located in the Department of Justice. And so the Office of the Public Intervenor, I went to hire the best groundwater expert I could find that could review the Kennecott application under the mining laws to see if it could comply. Professor Doug Chertower at UW-Milwaukee did this research, reported back to the Public Intervenor Office and to the public in Wisconsin that he believed the science showed that that mine could operate in compliance with the new laws. The mine went in, operated. Kennecott then left the state when they were finished removing the ore. And the second mine came in, and that was Exxon's application to mine in northeastern part of Wisconsin. Hired the same groundwater expert. The same laws, of course, are in place, and he did the same scientific review, and his conclusion was that he could not, with a high degree of certainty, say to the public of Wisconsin that there would not be problems with that application, given the existing law. So I think what this shows is that our current mining laws have not been a moratorium on mining. They have protected our natural resources, and they have allowed for citizen input on no matter what your view is, which is appropriate and helpful and the right thing to do in a democracy. And so I do not understand why there was any demonstration of need to change our laws, both in terms of what we've seen the Republicans do to remove citizen opportunity for input or for lessening the environmental standards.
If people want to know more about your gubernatorial campaign, where can they go?
KathleenFalk.com, and I would so much appreciate your support, the support of your listeners, of their ideas on how we move our state forward, because once we undo what Governor Scott Walker has done, we then need to move us forward. You know, get people working, solve this terrible job loss that Wisconsin's now leading the nation in job losses over the last 6 months. Build better schools, protect our environment. And I am eager to go to work for the people of Wisconsin, and I respectfully and enthusiastically ask for all their support.
Well, thank you so much for being on today, Kathleen. Good luck in your campaign, and hopefully we'll get you on again either before or after you become governor.
Great. Thanks, Sarah, and I hope the rest of your Friday goes better.
Well, thank you so much. You have a great day now.
Bye-bye.
We are just speaking with Kathleen Falk. She is one of the candidates that's running for governor against Scott Walker, who hopefully within the next month or two, we will definitely have a recall election on him. Now I'm going to go straight to Chris Liebenthal, otherwise known as Capper. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I would be better if everything worked properly. We love technology when it works, but when it doesn't, it's really a pain in the butt. So
I think Scott Walker feels the same way.
So can I just blame it on Scott Walker? Can I, you know, all my technical difficulties today are just, it's Scott Walker's fault.
It works for me.
All right, that'll work. So we are speaking with you about the John Doe investigation. You have been following this extremely well since it started in 2010. Can you tell me any updates right now?
Well, since the last time we talked, there's been quite a few significant events. I know that we're pressed for time, so I'll just hit the highlights. Of course, the last time we talked, real close friend and strong ally of Scott Walker, Tim Russell, was arrested, as along was Russell's partner and another gentleman named Kevin Cavanaugh. Russell and Cavanaugh was arrested for embezzling from a veterans fund. And Pyrrhic, Russell's roommate, was arrested for some child enticement that the DA's office found as a tangent to their original investigation. Since that time, two more arrests were made and charges filed. One was against Darlene Link, who was the woman that basically started this whole investigation when she was caught blogging on JS Online and other political blogs during county time while she was at work. The other person that was arrested was a woman named Kelly Reinfleisch, who was Walker's deputy chief of staff for the last year. She was arrested for basically campaigning most of the time while she was at the county executive's office. They found a secret router and wireless system where they were using this to avoid open record requests and just go about running their campaign and running the campaign for Brett Davis, who was running for lieutenant governor in 2010. One other thing of significance that came up with Darlene Wink's arrest is that she entered into a plea bargain with the DA to take a lesser charge, and in agreement said she would testify against other defendants in this investigation, as well as talk about destruction of digital evidence, which would be, of course, you know, the erasing of computer records and other things that could be incriminating to Scott Walker and to his staff. Also, right at that time, the sheriff's office.
Hey, Chris.
Yes.
I don't want to cut you off, but can you speak up a little bit?
Sure. The sheriff's office had found a dumpster, presumably on a tip from maybe Darlene Wink or somebody else, that had been stashed away in a corner of an underground parking structure. Inside that dumpster was it was full of papers that had looked like they were there for a year or two, according to what I've been told. That could be very interesting and significant, considering that right after Walker left the Milwaukee County Executive's office, they had found a lot of computers and a lot of files went missing. And to the best of my knowledge, they hadn't found it yet. You know, it would make logic to say that these papers were maybe those missing files.
So basically, there is a dumpster in the back that had that's been there for like a year, and they found the files that they were missing. And someone just decided they're going to try to throw them out, and nothing it was never picked up.
Well, the dumpster, there's a lot of weird things about the dumpster that they found. Now, I got to emphasize, we don't know for sure what's in there, but you know, logic would lead one to think that it could be those missing files. But like I said, the dumpster was pushed into the corner, some isolated corner of an underground parking structure near the courthouse, and it had been locked. They had to break open the locking mechanism or whatever they had to keep it closed so that they could gain access to it. And, apparently from what my understanding is that they found a lot of stuff that they were looking for.
Okay. Now, is there any connection to the investigations to Voss, the Fitzgerald brothers, both Scott and Jeff, Grossman, and any other Republicans? Sorry. We've already have, a circle around Walker with his close allies. Plus, I've heard Charlie Sykes has been named, and I've heard that Reince Priebus has been named, and so.
Right. In the complaints against Darlene Wink, it specifies that, she was emailing Charlie Sykes, Reince Priebus, who is now the national director of the Republican Party. Also, Vicki McKenna, who's, one of the radio squawkers out in Madison, and James T. Harris, a former talk show host at WTMJ in Milwaukee. There was a lot of names with Kelly Reinfleisch. Basically, she was running Brett Davis's fundraising aspect and coordinating with Scott Walker's campaign while she was in her county office.
And Reinfleisch then has just been indicted and arrested this last week,
right?
Hasn't she?
Correct, just a few weeks ago.
Now, Wink, the one that started all, the one that had the secret router, the one that's kind of, she was also indicted not too long ago, but she gave a plea bargain.
Correct, and she's already pled guilty to two misdemeanors. And as I had said, she did so in exchange to act as a state's witness against the other defendants, as well as to cooperate with the investigation in regards to the destruction of digital material. Or in other words, erasing computer hard drives or trying to scrub them as much as they could to remove any incriminating evidence. What's ironic is that even in the complaint against her, they found on the secret email system that she was concerned about a PDF file disappearing and how she could erase it because she didn't want to go to jail.
And where was that found?
She had an email exchange with Tim Russell, who seems to be involved in all of this stuff to some extent, that she had created a PDF file for a campaign event, a fundraising event, and was concerned about how to erase it from the computer because if anybody found it, she was afraid of going to jail.
Wow.
So, it's not a big surprise that she would turn and become a state witness against all these other people. And, to be fair, her role in all of this was relatively minor. She did do campaign work. She was sending out flyers and fundraising requests during county time from her county office, which is, of course, illegal. But compared to some of the other things that the other defendants were doing, this is really, small beans. I think the most significant thing to me about this whole recent series of events was that in the complaints against Kelly Reinfleisch, they're talking about her level of activity, which was remarkably high. She literally had told a friend she was spending half her time doing campaign work while she was at the county office. But in that complaint, it shows that Scott Walker, after Darlene Link had been after Darlene Link had been found out and publicly reported that she was doing this political activity on county time, Scott Walker, using his campaign email address, emailed Tim Russell and told him that they couldn't afford another story like this, and told Tim Russell that meant no more laptops, no more websites, no more time away from the office during the workday. So that tells me that Scott Walker knew all this stuff was going on. And especially because Russell, at that time, when he sent this email, was no longer in the county executive's office. He was in another position in another building within the county system.
So there's no reason that Scott Walker should have even been emailing him about anything.
Well, he's going around publicly stating that he didn't know anything was happening and that, quote unquote, his integrity was going to stay intact. But the complaint shows that that's a blatant lie, because it shows that he knew exactly what was happening. He knew who was doing it. And even though Russell was no longer in the county executive office, and even though this would have been a personnel issue, he chose to handle it through his campaign email to a guy that wasn't even in his executive office anymore.
Wow. Yep, he had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. And he's going to create 250,000 jobs, too.
Yeah. He didn't talk about the 300,000 he was going to lose. He just created 250,000. Chris, thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate it. We're going to speak to you next week about John Doe and see if there's any updates and see if we can go in detail about some of the stuff. And I'm sure more things will come out as the weeks go on. So.
Oh, without a doubt, I'm sure it will be.
What is your blog? It's Cognitive Dissonance.
That's E-I-S-S-I-D-E-N-C-E. The URL for it is cognitiveDissonance.blogspot.com.
Okay, and we will speak to you next week. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on today.
And thank you for having me on. Right. Have a good weekend.
Well, thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Chris Liebenthal. He writes so much about Scott Walker, it's hard to keep him apart sometimes. That was Chris Liebenthal with Cognitive Dissonance, and he's been following the John Doe investigation. If you want to follow the John Doe investigation, his blog is a great way to do it. He's right on top of everything. Be right back with Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine to talk about CPAC.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Scott Walker's been spending a whole lot of time outside of Wisconsin, and not on state business for that matter. When grassroots activists handed in 1 million signatures last month to recall Walker, he wasn't in Wisconsin, he was in New York City trying to shake down former AIG executives for campaign contributions. This week, on Wednesday, he was in Naples, Florida, at the Ritz-Carlton Golf Resort for a luncheon hosted by a conservative think tank. There, he said, if he prevails in his recall election, we will send a powerful message to state houses and state capitals all across this country. I'm afraid he's right about that. It'd be open season on public sector workers. Already, Indiana has followed suit, and Arizona and Utah are coming up right behind. Just about every single Republican governor across the country would go after the right to organize. Walker also told the folks at the golf resort that collective bargaining isn't a right, it's an expensive entitlement. But he couldn't be more wrong about that one. It's a right enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the U.S. is a signatory to. Walker's peddling the same reactionary message to CPAC in Washington, D.C. Fortunately, protesters awaited him there, just as they did in Florida and anywhere else he goes, including every single hamlet in Wisconsin. Because if you take people's rights away, they fight back. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Well, I'd like to welcome Liz DiNovella. Am I saying your name right?
You are.
Wonderful. From the Progressive Magazine, she's one of the editors, and she was lucky enough to go to the CPAC meeting. Now, can you tell people what CPAC is?
Yes, CPAC is the Conservative Political Action Conference, and the acronym is CPAC. And it is the largest conference of conservatives that happens every year, and there were more than 10,000 people at this three-day conference held in Washington, D.C. So all of the Republican candidates running for president were there, and also Wisconsin was front and center at this conference, and so that's why I decided to go.
Well, what did they talk about with Wisconsin?
Well, I should say that it's a conference, but it's also sort of a rah-rah for people to get excited about the party and about what's happening with Republicans. Even though it's technically not a Republican event, it is very much, you know, hand in glove, grassroots activists, Republican establishment people coming together. Well, Wisconsin is seen as being a real victory for the conservative movement in the United States. As much as sort of the left and liberals and progressives in Wisconsin are energized here in Wisconsin and also nationwide, you have the same thing happening on the other side. And so Wisconsin, in what Governor Walker has done, is seen as this model of how to deal with labor rights. Governor Walker gave the keynote speech on Friday night, and he was introduced by Reince Priebus, who is also from Wisconsin, who is now the head of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. And then Paul Ryan gave the keynote speech on Thursday night. So really, Wisconsin was a big deal at this conference.
And how charged and excited were the people there? I mean, was this? I know I was listening to Scott Walker's speech, and there was a lot of claps. And at the end of it, actually, I was watching it. At the end of it, some lady jumped up on stage and had a big Scott Walker sign and was like bouncing all around, and they had to push her off stage.
Right.
So, is that indicative of what happened at the entire conference?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, people there were definitely energized, very excited. But they were also, the establishment was definitely, the Republican establishment was also trying to create that excitement. And so, as people sort of are aware, you know, Mitt Romney is not really being embraced wholeheartedly by the base. And so this was sort of an opportunity to sort of really play to the base. And so people were very excited about what Governor Walker had done. But there was also sort of a disconnect, too, in that when I would talk to people about Wisconsin and talk to them about what they thought of the John Doe investigation, you know, people didn't know anything about that.
Well, and that's part of the fact that the mainstream media isn't picking that up. The only one writing about it is Bice on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's the only one that's ever been writing about it. Anything that's out there is out there because of the bloggers.
It's true. And, you know, I think the No Quarter Bice has done this tremendous job. And, I mean, Cognitive Dissonance has done an amazing job. But it's true. Bloggers have played a really important role in breaking this story. My colleague Ruth Conniff here at the Progressive, the cover story for the March issue, which just arrived in the office yesterday, is about the corruption probe and what's going on. And so it's true. It's really, if you're in Wisconsin, you know about what's going on. But what's happening here doesn't seem to matter when it comes to what's happening nationally and how the Republicans are using what's happening in Wisconsin to sort of create their brand, so to speak. I think what we're going to see is Republicans are going to, you know, they're really sort of posing themselves off as being, you know, these nice Midwesterners from small towns in Wisconsin. You know, that's sort of how they talk, and as if to sort of distance themselves from, you know, being in Washington D.C. or more importantly, distancing themselves from President Obama and being a Chicago Democrat and all the sort of baggage that comes along with that idea. So in a way, what happens here on the ground in Wisconsin doesn't seem to matter that much at the conference. People were just excited about Paul Ryan. People were excited about Governor Walker. And people think that Walker has done this tremendously good job.
And his speech really made it sound like that. I mean, if he focused specifically on financials, he just talked about all the cuts that they did, and he spoke, he basically, his message was basically for them. He spoke their language. He didn't talk about the effects they were having. They just said, look what we've done versus what Illinois has done.
Exactly. It's, again, it's that comparison between Wisconsin and Illinois. And again, I think we're going to continue to see that on the presidential election going towards November. But this is what he said. This is a direct quote. Some other states used budget gimmicks and tricks to balance their budget. We didn't have to do that. You know, and that is happening the same time that he's, you know, using the mortgage settlement money to plug a hole in his budget. You know, and so it that's the whole thing. This conference wasn't about logic. It wasn't about necessarily facts, but it was about playing to people's emotions, and that's exactly what Scott Walker did. And he also, you know, went there and asked for money and for supporters to come to Wisconsin to help him with his ground game. So it was almost sort of shameless how forthright he was about asking for money and about asking people to come to Wisconsin.
Yeah, he did that at the end of his speech. And I actually have portions a portion of his speech after we get back from the top of the hour break that I want to play. When I play it, I'll tell you why I found it the most important. I thought one of the most important things that he said in there. But mm-hmm. He did. He made a good 3 to 5 minutes of I need money, the big government union bosses. I love that term because it makes no mm-hmm. sense to me. But
we'll get to that. We'll get to that after the break, what that
okay.
term means.
Yeah, because I'd like to. But he kept talking about how the unions are spending more and more and more money and that he needs help and it's all, you know, he needs to stay in. And so it was very shameless on him.
And I had been to a bunch of other speakers, and I had gone to a couple of panels. There was a panel about labor in the return of big labor, what the right has learned in Ohio and Wisconsin, and I'd like to talk about that after the break. But I did not hear anybody sort of pitch for money in that sort of obvious sort of way. But, you know, he was in a room full of people who have given hundreds of thousands of dollars to candidates. So, you know, it wasn't a bad place in the way to make a pitch if you want to make money. And that does not even include all the sort of back room, behind the scenes asks and meetings that happened that I was not privy to.
And that's where I would think that he would be more likely to ask for money. Hey, I'm here. Let's open your checkbook and write me one. So I was kind of surprised to hear him stand up and go, by the way, give me money. Send me money.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised too.
So, all right, well, Liz, hold on here. We'll be right back with Liz DiNovola from the Progressive Magazine talking about CPAC, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
All around me are familiar faces. But there's a fight that we have to win before November. And that's in Wisconsin. The entrenched liberal interests want to take the state back to the days of big government and big deficits when big labor called the shots. And when Scott Walker took office, he delivered on his campaign promises. He balanced the budget, saved teachers from layoffs, empowered local districts and municipalities, and ended the days of pay-for-play politics. Wisconsin families are better off. Our communities are better off. But let me tell you, the public union bosses are angry and refuse to go down without a fight. They're pulling out every trick in the book because, after all, hornets are always angriest when you try to destroy their nests.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and that was Reince Priebus at CPAC. That was part of his little speech. And I'm speaking with Liz DiNovella from the Progressive Magazine, who was there at CPAC. And he mentioned unions, and you went to a workshop that talked about how the bills in Ohio unions versus the bills in Wisconsin unions and what worked and what didn't. It was actually kind of creepy reading your story. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, there was a panel called The Return of Big Labor, you know, what conservative movement has learned about Wisconsin and Ohio. And I want to point out that the four people that were on the panel, all of them who were white guys, none of them were from either Wisconsin or Ohio. They were from right-wing think tanks, either in Washington, D.C. or in New York City. So I think that's important to sort of point out. So they really looked at what Walker did, in that he pushed through this anti-union legislation that ended collective bargaining, and it also ended the automatic dues deduction for many public sector workers. And this is what the right thinks is really fantastic about Walker has done. What they really want to do is not just end collective bargaining, but they really want to stop the automatic dues deductions for public sector workers. And that's because if you don't have those union dues, then union activity when it in politics, and by that means, you know, spending in politics, that declines. And so it's really a way to make it so difficult for unions to spend money in electoral politics. And here in Wisconsin, they have been some of the top donors to both parties. And so that's what's really behind the assault on workers' rights in Wisconsin. So they look at what happened with Governor Walker and what happened there. And then they looked at what was happening in Ohio. And so in Ohio, the Governor Kasich there and their Republican majorities in both chambers, they passed similar legislation as Act 10 here in Wisconsin. In Ohio, it was called SB 5. Voters last November repealed the law, so it isn't happening. But we have a recall. In Ohio, they don't have a recall, but they're able to have a referendum and to repeal laws they don't like. The difference between what happened in Ohio and what happened in Wisconsin is that Ohio's legislation included public safety workers. And because there's this one guy, he is a lawyer with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. His name is Vince Vernuccio. He said that Wisconsin was more successful than Ohio because Governor Walker exempted health and safety workers. And so this is a direct quote from him. In Ohio, essentially what you had is firemen and police in uniform going door to door saying this bill will kill babies. Now, when you have police and firemen in uniform saying the apocalypse is going to happen, it's very hard to message against that. The problem is we didn't get our message into Ohio soon enough. So that is sort of the big difference between, or how the right sees the difference between Wisconsin and Ohio, is that Wisconsin was good in that it exempted public and safety workers. Of course, this does not take into account the massive solidarity that was shown by, you know, the firefighters and the police you know, the police unions who, you know, who marched, you know, with everybody else who was concerned about labor rights.
Well, it strikes me as interesting that they would have this workshop saying, look, it worked in Wisconsin but not in Ohio because of this, yet when you talk to anyone, you know, with Scott Walker and about the people running against him for the recall, all they talk about is collective bargaining, and Scott Walker is making it the key reason why he is actually getting the recall and why over a million people did sign. So what we see in Wisconsin is what we saw in Ohio, except Ohio couldn't recall, I believe it's Kasich, isn't it?
Right.
You know, okay.
Correct.
Couldn't recall him, which I'm sure if they could, they would have, and they could only speak on the bill, whereas we don't really have the power to get rid of the bill, but we can recall our governor. So it's actually the same thing with the same amount of people in a different way, and it's curious to me why they aren't seeing that kind of connection.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing, and what this guy from the Competitive Enterprise Institute said was similar to what Governor Walker has said, that, you know, it was about messaging. You know, it's never about contents. It's about messaging. That's how they really feel about what they're doing around labor rights. And so what they're going to do is, in other states, is that they're going to have this similar types of legislation as Act 10 in Wisconsin or SB 5 in Ohio, but instead of making it one big, broad chunk, they're going to break it into smaller pieces. And then they'll pass the smaller pieces of legislation and make it into smaller, more digestible parts. And so for them, it's not that Governor Walker did anything wrong. It's not that what they did in Ohio was wrong. It's that they sort of bit off more than they could chew in Ohio and that they need to break it down into smaller pieces. You know, again, it's not about the content of the bills. It's about they didn't do a good enough job messaging.
And that's interesting. First of all, the Republicans are very big on messaging, and it's always these nice, friendly, little, happy-sounding things, and they're always such horrible bills. But they also have a lot of the newspapers and radio stations on their side, so it would be very easy for them to do messaging, whereas, obviously, as you see in the John Doe investigation, it's hard to even get this message out because the bloggers and only one guy out of mainstream media is actually writing anything against them.
It's true, and, you know, we haven't had really good labor reporting in the mainstream for, you know, almost 30 years. I mean, once upon a time, you would have a business section and you'd have labor being covered in that. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that we've seen the number of unionized workers go down dramatically. But it's true. I mean, labor and labor issues are not covered enough by the mainstream press overall.
And yet Walker's saying that his messaging didn't work.
Well, remember, that's what he said a couple months ago. If he would do anything different, he would have gone out and talked to people more and get his message out earlier about what he was going to do. You know, he didn't regret doing the whole bill overall. He just regretted he didn't talk to people soon enough. And I thought that was very revealing.
Well, and the people he's talking to obviously aren't going to be the union people. They're going to be what he would consider the people, the manufacturer, the owners, his supporters.
Exactly, and he said that at his talk at CPAC, which, again, as we had mentioned, is this conservative activist conference. He had said that, you know, it was important for him to just do speeches when he gave his sort of so-called fireside chat that, you know, a year ago. And he wanted to talk directly to the people. He didn't want to have to go through the filter of the media, he said. You know, but, you know, he also didn't want to take, you know, be asked tough questions. So, you know, he definitely feels that. I mean, I think both sides sort of have their criticisms of the mainstream media on this issue.
That's true. And speaking of his speech, here's about 2 minutes, a little under 2 minutes of Scott Walker at CPAC.
The big government union bosses understand this isn't just about who the governor of Wisconsin is. And it's not even just about what the momentum or impact will be on the November 2012 elections will be. Certainly those are factors. More importantly, they understand there's something bigger at stake here. What's at stake in this election is fundamentally about courage. You see, I'm an optimist, so I believe with your help and the help of others like you around my state and around this country, I believe we will prevail. And when we do, it won't just be about electing or electing again a governor in the state of Wisconsin. It'll be about sending a message not only in Madison, in my state house, It'll be about sending a message in Springfield and St. Paul and Columbus and Indianapolis and Austin and in the halls of Congress right down the way in our nation's capital. When we prevail, it will send a powerful message to every politician in America. And if you stand up and do the right thing, if you tackle the tough challenges, if you make the tough choices, there will be men and women in every state and every part of this country who will stand up shoulder to shoulder, arm to arm with you and say, yes, we will support you if you do what is right and courageous. This is that time. And Lord help us if we fail. Lord help us if we fail. I believe fundamentally, having looked at this more closely over time, if we fail, and I'm not planning on it, but if we were to fail, I think this sets aside any courageous act in American politics for at least a decade, if not a generation. That is why we must not fail.
The one thing that struck me in that segment, and I actually had to listen to it two or three times on the computer,
mm-hmm.
is he used we. He's not talking to anyone in Wisconsin.
No.
He is talking at a conference. I don't even know where the conference was. It wasn't in Wisconsin, that's for sure.
No, it was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and it was, thank you. And he used we the entire segment there. 2 minutes of we need this, we need that, we need to win. I need your help. We need to. These aren't his constituents. I mean, it was very telling for me that he just kept using we the entire time through that segment.
Definitely. And, you know, he's definitely, one of the big terms at this conference, of course, was freedom. It's all about freedom and all about courage. And so he definitely was, you know, playing to his audience, as all good politicians do, and, you know, framing this issue to be about freedom. Because the people at CPAC definitely feel that they are the people who are really valiant and really courageous and who are really fighting to save the country. And so everything sort of gets wrapped around the idea of freedom.
And courage. Freedom
and courage.
I think he said courage four times.
Yes, that's the thing. You know, it's all about him having the courage to do this sort of thing. You know, and it plays into the whole line about, you know, people of courage. And again, but the way people talked about it, you know, at other parts of the conferences, or at least I should say, you know, the keynote speakers, the people who, you know, sat in the main, who spoke at the main ballroom, who, you know, addressed the supporters, many of whom, the majority of whom had been involved in sort of Tea Party activities, you know, they really talked a lot about freedom and courage.
Well, what kind of freedom are they talking about?
Well, And they ultimately, it comes down to freedom from government. That's how that is the big thing. And so this is the whole thing about the Tea Party and what the Republican Party, you know, how they're sort of messaging, what their PR is that, you know, if you remember back in 2009 when the Tea Party, you know, started, it started out as people being really mad at Wall Street and people being mad at big business. But what the Tea Party has done, and what politicians, especially people like Paul Ryan here from Wisconsin, you know, they've been able to sort of morph anger at big business into anger at big government. And so that's why you see the Republicans and conservatives railing so much against big government. And this is why you saw, you know, people like Reagan being talked about over and over and over again. I mean, it's almost as if the George W. Bush administration did not even happen. You know, people rarely talked about Bush. And when they did, it was in a dismissive sort of way because, you know, he made government huge. George W. Bush made the deficits huge. You know, all these things that the right wing is criticizing Obama for, you know, George Bush did and did it even more so. And if you ask them, well, you know, well, what about Bush? What, you know, why did you not care about big government with the Patriot Act or why didn't he care about deficits under George Bush, they just sort of wave it off and say, well, you know, he wasn't really a Republican. Which is why they sort of have to go back to Ronald Reagan, and, you know, a mythical Ronald Reagan. I mean, most of the people in that audience don't remember that Reagan actually raised taxes in 1986. You know, it really comes down to being this very emotional conference. It's about making people feel good. It might making people feel connected. You know, these real true believers who believe that in courage and freedom and all that sort of patriotism.
But yet they don't mention democracy.
They do, but I think they sort of talk about it in a different sort of way. You know, when they talk, well, actually, I think in a really revealing panel I went to, and I will actually be writing a piece for the Center for Media and Democracy in the coming days on this, is I went to a panel on campaign finance reform, and there were the lawyers there who had actually been the people who, you know, had argued for Citizens United, which had, has unleashed corporate spending into our political system, you know, the Supreme Court ruling from 2010. So, you know, when they talk about democracy, you know, they talk about the free market of ideas, and they think that all the money spent in the election is a good thing. It just means more democracy. So, you know, when they talk about democracy, you know, it's in a very sort of particular way.
Well, last thing I wanted you to describe, you heard at the beginning of Walker's speech that he talked about the big government union bosses. Can you kind of explain why they're now using that term? Because every time he said union bosses, he said big government union bosses.
Exactly. It was a term that I actually flagged myself. And this, again, goes back to how the right wing and how the Tea Party and how people like Paul Ryan are sort of framing this issue. You know, again, you know, when the economy started to tank, people got really angry at Wall Street. People were really mad at big business. And again, you know, suddenly the anger that was directed towards big business is now being directed at big government. So now suddenly big government is the problem. And that's what we need to get out of the way. And so, you know, people would say stuff that, you know, people like Paul Ryan, you know, could somehow talk about crony capitalism, even though it was the policies that the Republican administration of George Bush, that was what got us into the economic mess to begin with. And so, again, you have this real anger being directed at big government now. And so what Walker did is he put together anger at big government along with anger at union bosses, because, you know, the people at CPAC just really do not like unions at all, because, you know, they are an impediment to everything. You have, you know, the melding together of this term that in many ways makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, big government union bosses, I mean, what does that even mean? I mean, maybe because going after public sector workers, there's sort of some sort of like government issue, but you're right in that, you know, it kind of doesn't make any sense. And yet what he's really sort of criticizing is, you know, the government and any sort of regulation to begin with.
And if people want more information on your anything that you're writing about CPAC or want more about the Progressive magazine, where can they go?
You can go to progressive.org, which is the magazine's website. I've also written stuff on CPAC for Dane101.com. And you can also check out my own website, which is Liz DiNovella. And you can also follow me on Twitter.
Well, thank you so much for being on today, Liz. That was it was great that you were there, unfortunately, but it was great to hear what had happened and the workshops that they put on, because obviously these bills aren't being written by our legislatures. They're being written by someone, but it's not for this state or in this state. So, and that just really brought that point home. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. It was fun.
Yep. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
That was Liz DiNovella from the Progressive magazine. And if you want more information, like she said, you can go to progressive.org. I'm going to go right to Scott Witkoff because he's been wonderfully graciously holding on here while I finish speaking with Liz. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. Good. No, the conversation was great. So it was it was fun to wait and listen.
Well, Scott Witkoff is the writer of Badger Democracy, an amazing blog that started about a year ago, wasn't it?
It was just about a year ago. It's actually been just a little less than a year. Yeah.
And he has been amazing at writing about what's going on and doing some really in-depth studies and breaking articles. So, Scott, speaking of breaking articles, there was a bunch of memos that were released yesterday, last evening, regarding the redistricting.
Right.
And right. Did you get a chance to look at them, skim through them, read them?
I stayed up late last night reading all 84 emails, and it's astonishing. When you look at the intentional, the intentional deception that's going on, and it's just astonishing. I was stunned. You know, as I was reading them and, you know, and going, you know, deeper into them, how different groups were being manipulated, how different people were being manipulated and fed information, you know, to favor this redistricting. And it's astonishing. And I would agree. I heard John Nichols this morning who said that, you know, he felt after seeing the court's decision on ordering the release of these emails, that the redistricting was going to be thrown out. And based on reading these, I would tend to agree. There's deliberate deception and deliberate collusion going on between key members of both Fitzgerald staff and the attorneys for Michael Beston Friedrich and Jim Troupas. And it's stunning. Yeah.
I wasn't able to read a lot. I skimmed through a little bit. There was one I read that talked about gerrymandering, and they wrote it right in there. Well, we can gerrymander this. And I'm like, wow,
right.
That's slightly
right.
Illegal. Well, thank you for putting it out there for us.
Right. And the way that they manipulated Eileen Bruskowitz, who's a Dane County supervisor, who was brought in to testify in favor of the Dane County map, she was... Yeah, you know, she was given the information that the GOP Michael Beston Friedrich attorneys wanted her to have to give a favorable view of the Dane County map when she had never even seen the map. And they specifically say, look, you need to get her this information because she's not going to see the maps. And it's stunning. They outline talking points for her. You know, it's amazing. It is just astonishing. And I have to say, you know, and I'm going to be publishing this today, so I'm giving your listeners and you a sneak preview. I have been researching, based on a tip, a gentleman by the name of Ronald Keith Gaddy, who's a professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma. And he's one of the top redistricting experts and consultants in the country, who was brought in as a consultant by the Fitzgerald brothers, and specifically Michael Beston Friedrich. And I had gotten a tip that he was in Madison back in May doing some top secret work with Michael Beston Friedrich. And at the time, the source didn't know exactly what it was, but as all this became clear, it was apparent that it was on the redistricting. And Professor Gaddy, I had been trying to find out exactly what part he played in the redistricting, and the emails that were released yesterday just happened coincidentally to put things together. And I'm going to be publishing something today because it turns out that what Professor Gaddy's expertise is in minority districts and the redistricting and treatment of minority districts. And the emails show that there was significant participation with some of the Hispanic groups in Milwaukee, and that they were manipulated to favor the redistricting maps. And I can explain it more thoroughly in a blog because it's kind of complicated. You need the links to see what Professor Gaddy does. But if I can just give you a snapshot of what his expertise is and how he affects redistricting around the country, because he's been involved in Texas, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, and as many people who listen to your show probably know, the Texas redistricting is also in the courts. What Professor Gaddy specializes in is showing that Voter Rights Act language and requirements are no longer needed in redistricting. And he uses some pretty snazzy statistical tricks and methods to demonstrate that because of the increase in voter participation in African American and Hispanic populations, that redistricting doesn't need to take that into account. And then what he does is he takes that information, and where GOP legislators bring him in to help draw the minority districts, they'll give about a 2% increase in representation in a minority district, and then very carefully craft the surrounding districts, drawing from this gerrymandering and taking different populations and moving them around to make the surrounding districts more conservative. So I don't know if that makes sense, but where it's really effective is then you have overrepresentation of non-minority voters because they get blocked in these small pockets of representation, and then the surrounding districts all become conservative.
And that was the big problem in Milwaukee. Sorry, I cut you off.
You hit the nail right on the head. That's the problem in Milwaukee. And the influence of Professor Gaddy is his expertise in showing the attorneys at Michael Besson Friedrich and the GOP how to accomplish that. So in essence, you get an overrepresented statewide majority of conservative and underrepresented minorities. And he backs it up by the research that he does and, you know, all the books that he's written and all the articles that he's written, and he's done that in numerous states, and he brought it to Wisconsin. And it's been very underreported, and there's even one of the emails is titled Gaddy and Hendrick. And it specifically discusses, you know, his timeline of when he's coming in, and, you know, I'm just, here it is, you know, talks about when he's coming in, he can train on the system, as in the software system, and then we can meet to discuss substantive issues and concerns. We can create an agenda for the days he is here that will fit with your work and ensure we maximize his input and education. And then it says also Eric, and he's referring to Eric, this is from Jim Troupas, he's referring to Eric McLeod, who's the attorney with Michael Best, who headed the redistricting. Can you pull up and send over the pleadings index from the last go-around? I would like to get some of the items to review and provide Keith Gaddy with some of those as well. And what he's talking about is that Gaddy was also a consultant in 2002. He was brought in by Scott Jensen and the GOP majority in the assembly at that time to do their work, and that case also went to court. And Gaddy was brought in as an expert witness at that time to testify on behalf of the GOP. And the pleadings he's talking about are the index of pleadings from that court case so that they can reference and be prepared for what could potentially come down the line to defend what they're doing. So this is going back to, you know, April of last year, and Gaddy visited Madison for 5 days in May, and they were already preparing for what they knew was going to be, you know, some tricky gerrymandering and dealings in how they treated the minority population. So these emails are going to, and I've actually forwarded this information already to Voces de la Frontera as far as the work that Professor Gaddy has done, because he hasn't come up in, you know, any media at this point. And I'll be publishing the article today. But this was an absolute intentional manipulation of the minority populations in Wisconsin to underrepresent them and concentrate the conservative majority populations surrounding them so that they are intentionally underrepresented. And these emails prove that they knew what they were doing. And it's, I couldn't believe it. I was stunned when I was reading them last night because it's collusion, plain and simple. And as all this moves forward, the preliminary part of the trial starts Tuesday. So it will be very interesting to see what happens.
On that, we're going to take a quick break. So, Scott, hang on here. And we will be right back with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hello, I'm Assistant Democratic Leader Sandy Pasch with this week's Democratic Address. Under Governor Walker and the legislative Republican majority, Wisconsin's reputation for clean, honest, and transparent government has taken a serious hit. Again and again, they have chosen to reward special interests and big corporate donors over working families across our state. This all began about a year ago when the governor introduced his budget repair bill, which rolled back 50 years of worker rights and divided our state like never before. But it also included a tax on good government, such as allowing the governor to replace 39 civil service positions in state agencies with his own political appointees and allowing for no bid contracts for the sale of state-owned power plants. Since that time, this unprecedented cloud of secrecy and scandal has only grown larger, from an ongoing criminal probe involving many of the governor's top advisors, to the governor raising millions in out-of-state campaign contributions, to the oath signed by Republicans to hide their taxpayer-funded redistricting plan from the public. Our citizens are simply losing faith in their government. That's why my fellow Democrats and I are putting forward a package of proposals that would reverse the worst abuses of power of the Walker administration and legislative Republicans and help restore integrity and trust in our government. These proposals will help to restore integrity in all branches of government, including eliminating the governor's newly created positions for his political appointees, ending unlimited fundraising during a recall petition period, and measures that would help reestablish faith in our judicial system. The people of our state need and deserve to know that their elected leaders are going to bat for them, not for corporate donors and politically connected special interests. We are serious about working to restore the public's trust and faith in government after a year of extreme and divisive actions under Governor Walker and his Republican allies. And our proposals present a solid first step toward repairing that trust and restoring Wisconsin's proud tradition of open and transparent government. The people of Wisconsin deserve nothing less. Thank you.
Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the quid pro quo with We Act, the teachers union? Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the other gubernatorial candidates that are now lining up to run against Governor Walker, who stood at the podium and cut a deal with them? The mayor of Milwaukee now saying, listen, I can't really line that up right now. And other members, even of this body, who have been talking about this all week, about the blurry line that exists between the Democratic Party of Wisconsin and its members and the public employee unions. Is that what this is about, Kathleen Falk? Kathleen Falk, who cut some deal, a gubernatorial candidate with $24,000 in her account, and yet is standing at the podium embracing Mary Bell, hugging, literally standing arm in arm. Is that what you're talking about? Is that what this discussion is about today in the Senate? About Kathleen Falk and the corruption that now exists between the unions and your gubernatorial candidate? Because if it is, I'd love to talk about that. We'll talk about it all day if you want.
You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we're talking to Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. Sorry, Scott. We are talking about the redistricting. I couldn't help myself. I had to play it again. That was.
I love, you know, you listen to Scott Fitzgerald, and you could just, the wheels are just falling off. He knows he doesn't have the votes in the Senate to pass this mining bill that's in joint finance today. He knows he doesn't have the votes. And it is just amazing to see this desperation in him play out, because the obvious connection with Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce and all the money that they are willing to spend on the, you know, I wonder if there wasn't some kind of, and this is speculation, but I can imagine, you know, the meeting between Paul Buchan at WMC and Fitzgerald, where he says, hey, look, you get this mining bill through, or, you know, you're not going to have any money from us to defend your seat in a recall. Something ridiculous like that, but it would be so typical. And I can just see the desperation playing out, and that whole crazy thing about Kathleen Falk, you know, in the Senate. had a Democratic senator started on a rant like that, Can you imagine how loud the gaveling would be?
How quick it would be. As a matter of fact, let me play, because I've played that comment twice now. Let me actually play for you, and honest to goodness,
sure.
This is the honest to goodness truth. This is what was said right before you heard Kathleen, that whole Kathleen Falk comment. Here is Dave Hansen, the Senator Dave Hansen, speaking on the Senate floor. This may not be all of it, but this is all I had. This is what was said right before Scott Sterrell goes on his tangent with Kathleen Falk.
And what has been the result of the past year? Two Republican senators gone. Four more facing recall. A million people signing petitions to recall the governor. Over 800,000 signatures to recall the lieutenant governor. But perhaps the most difficult number to cope with is over 35,000 jobs being lost and counting as a result of policies that drain money from working families in our local economies and put it in the pockets of the wealthy and the out-of-state corporations. And Wisconsin being one of only four states in the continental U.S. that is looking at economic retraction, rather than expansion. Up until now, your policies went into place. Wisconsin's economy was actually improving. We were adding jobs until last summer. And now, as we watch nearly every other state turn the corner, we are left to watch as they leave us, the state of Wisconsin, behind. Happy anniversary. Well done.
Well, it is the anniversary, but I'm wondering what we're talking about. Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the quid pro quo with WEAC, the teachers union? Are we talking about Kathleen Falk and the other gubernatorial candidates that are now lining up to run against Governor Walker, who stood at the podium and cut a deal with them, the mayor of Milwaukee now saying, listen, I can't really line that up right now, and other members even of this body who have been talking about this all week, about the blurry line that exists between the Democratic Party of Wisconsin and its members and the public employee unions. Is that what this is about, Kathleen Falk? Kathleen Falk, who cut some deal, a gubernatorial candidate with $24,000 in her account, and yet is standing at the podium embracing Mary Bell, hugging, literally standing arm in arm. Is that what you're talking about? Is that what this discussion is about today in the Senate, about Kathleen Falk and the corruption that now exists between the unions and your gubernatorial candidate? Because if it is, I'd love to talk about that. We'll talk about it all day if you want. Please, you've got to be kidding me. And for the senator from the 30th, boy, I wish Representative Nygren would have got enough signatures to get on the ballot, because you'd be gone too right now. Mr. President, I would ask that we would adjourn till 12:01, so this body can come back and do do the business of the body with the third reading at this time.
That was Senator Dave Hansen, and then that was Senator Scott Fitzgerald's response, the entirety of it. It didn't even make sense. It didn't even correlate. And when he's talking about the senator from the 30th, he was actually going back to Senator Dave Hansen, because Representative Nygren in the recall, instead of just, I think it was Kim Simak. No, Kim Simak was against Halpern. Anyway, the person running against Senator Hansen made it on, but Representative Nygren was one signature shy of making it on. And that is what Scott Fitzgerald is referencing to at that moment.
Right. And you notice, you know, you're supposed to address the chair in debate on the Senate floor. And he directly references Senator Hansen by saying, you. And not only is it, you know, uncivil in the Senate, he was directly attacking Senator Hansen. When Senator Hansen was making a statement on the anniversary and of Act 10 and the protests and, you know, how ridiculous the wetlands bill, that then they were brought back at 12:01 a.m., technically the next day, to do the third reading so that it could pass. And, with Fitzgerald. And then, of course, the whole announcement with the mining bill, the select committee being dissolved and moved into joint finance, which is occurring right now, it's going to – look, they can debate all day. But it's going to pass joint finance on a party line vote, and you know then be messaged to the Senate. But he doesn't have the votes in the Senate. Unless something really drastic changes, and there's some additional threats made. My understanding is that they were in meetings all day on Wednesday and Thursday to try and bring everybody in line, to get the caucus behind, SB, well, it's SB 488, AB 426, the mining bill. But there are some real issues there, because, remember, none of the Republican members of that select committee on mining jobs knew what Fitzgerald was going to do. The rug was pulled right out from under them, and he pulled the rug right out from his own party. To take that assembly bill that's very, very unpopular and has some serious issues, and to throw it at the feet of the GOP in the Senate, who, again, like Hansen said, four of whom are going to face recall.
We have Scott, I don't want to cut you off. I have a very limited amount of time, and I have a couple questions I want to get to, and I don't know if we can get to them all, but with Scott Fitzgerald, it was mainly Scott and Jeff Fitzgerald with the redistricting. Now you see Scott Fitzgerald losing it. I mean, so Scott was really instrumental in all of this. Do you think he's just seriously losing it? Do you think with the memos coming out, knowing that it was only through his office, knowing that he made all the Republicans sign, knowing that a Republican came out and said we were shown two maps, one that was for us, one that was against us, and if we didn't go along, we were going to get the map that was against us. Do you think he just knows that his time is up, and he's just, like you said, the wheels are just starting to fall off?
I think you're starting to see where his loyalty lies. And it's not with the people of Wisconsin, and it's not with the people of his district. It's with the money interests that put him into office and give him his marching orders. Because he knows if he's voted out of office, he'll get a nice cushy job as a lobbyist or some type of private consultant, and he'll make millions. So I think you see a man who just, he knows where his future lies, and it's most likely not with the people of his district in the state of Wisconsin, and that the court's going to really smack down his actions. And, he'll go off and do what Tommy Thompson did, and, he'll make millions as a lobbyist. And I think he doesn't care.
Yeah, I think that we're going to wrap it up with that. And I'd like to thank you for being on, Scott. I'd love to get you back on again soon, and we can talk more about this once the memos come out more. We can talk more about the Scott Fitzgerald and him just kind of losing it and Yeah, like you said, he just doesn't care. So thank you so much. And what, real quick, what's that website people can go and read your blogs at?
You can Google Badger Democracy. It's a WordPress hosted blog. So it's bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com, or just Google Badger Democracy. And thanks for all your hard work, Sarah.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all your hard work, Scott. Keep up the fight, and we'll talk with you soon.
You too.
Thanks.
Bye.
We're just talking with Scott Witkoff, the blogger from Badger Democracy. Now I'm going to go straight to Elizabeth Wheeler. She is from Clean, Wisconsin. And hello, Elizabeth. Thank you for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I know we don't have a lot of time, so I kind of just jumped right to you. There is a wetland bill that was passed at 12:01, 12:10 Wednesday morning. And I know we talked a little bit about it last time you were on, but can you go into a little more detail on what this bill really is and what the Senate has passed?
Yeah, absolutely. So the wetlands bill that the Senate passed on Wednesday morning, like you described, and I heard Scott mention a little bit as well, basically takes away wetland protections under Wisconsin law that have been afforded to our wetlands for a long, long time. Wetlands in Wisconsin are a really critical part of our ecology. They are part of what makes our state so special, and they sustain our clean water and our wildlife, and so they're really important. And for Wisconsin has a long tradition of recognizing their importance in our ecology and protecting them. Now, the bill that was passed by the Senate earlier this week takes away some of the protections that we've historically given to wetlands. It fails to distinguish between low-quality and high-quality wetlands, and we view this as a major problem because some wetlands could be recreated in other places of the state or could be mitigated if they're destroyed. And some wetlands should be really protected under the law and should never be destroyed because they are of ecological significance, they're high quality, they provide important wildlife habitat, and also provide important water quality protections. Now, the bill also prioritizes mitigation for developers that want to fill wetlands. Right now, if a developer wants to fill wetlands, they have to show that filling wetlands is the only way the project can happen, and the project is beneficial to the public and serves all sorts of other functions for the public. And they're required under current law to avoid all wetland impacts if they can. If they can't avoid them, then they're allowed to do some mitigation. The bill changes this so that developers can come in with a mitigation plan, and the DNR has to evaluate whether under that mitigation plan if there is an adverse environmental impact to wetlands.
So basically, it changes the whole scope of how things are done with wetlands and with developers then.
Right.
Is there any, if a developer does fill in a wetland, is there anything in there that says that they have to make another wetland or some sort? I mean, is there anything that can say that even if it doesn't protect them, they have to actually do something to create something close to that in another area?
Right. That's the mitigation plan that I referenced earlier, that if a developer wants to fill in a wetland, they can do so as long as they create a wetland somewhere else or restore a wetland that's been degraded or something like that.
And that
under current law and under the bill. Both.
Okay. So that hasn't changed then. I'm sorry, I'm talking over you. I'm sorry. That hasn't changed then. So if they come in and fill in the wetland, they have to. Now, you mentioned the good versus the high versus the low wetlands.
High-quality wetlands versus low-quality wetlands. A low-quality wetland might be something that is really common in the state, so it could be created in one place or another and perform a similar ecological functional value. It could be slightly degraded already due to surrounding developments, that kind of thing. A high-quality wetland is a pristine habitat and a wetland that is performing a unique ecological function.
So there could be a wetland that's out in the middle of a farm field somewhere that has a specific butterfly or specific plant or specific animal that's living out of that wetland that you don't find in the other wetlands. And by destroying that wetland, you could actually cause that species to go extinct in the area. And there's no distinction between the two, whereas you could fill in a low-quality wetland, and it doesn't seem like you're going to be, even though you're destroying a wetland, there seems to be a little bit less than some of your higher quality wetlands, which have more of a devastating effect on the environment.
Right. So under current law, we have some wetlands have extra protections because they're high quality, and this bill removes those extra protections and treats all the wetlands across the state the same.
What kind of devastation will that create within the environment?
Well, because Wisconsin's ecology is so integrated with our wetlands, we've got wetlands in all parts of the state, and it's a really unique feature of Wisconsin's ecology. Wetlands do all sorts of really important things for our environment. They clean the water. They filter toxins and other pollutants out of water, and the biggest two things are they clean the water and they provide habitat for unique species that are unique to Wisconsin. So if you degrade the wetlands, then you lose the water quality and you lose the species.
And we already have problems. Excuse me. With one second. Sorry about that. I had a little frog in my throat there, apparently. We already have problems with water quality, and now that they've removed some of the water aspects, they're trying to add more pollution. There's bills to try to add more pollution in there. So by getting rid of the wetlands, that's one less way the water can be cleaned, since the state isn't doing a lot of that anymore.
Right. So filling wetlands can lead to water quality issues. It can lead to additional flooding. It can lead to all sorts of environmental problems that actually impact our ability to live here.
How does that impact towns that maybe have wetlands around them or in them that they're using for tourist attractions? Let's say they want to have bird watching or whatever they're doing there. How would that affect those towns? Are those protected because they're economic boons to that town?
No, I don't think that they would be. I mean, the Department of Natural Resources could look at an area and do sort of a balancing test to determine if they think that it would be too detrimental to fill a particular wetland because it's a economic benefit for the area. I know that the sportsman groups, Ducks Unlimited, Wisconsin Wetlands Association, Wisconsin Wildlife, all of those groups were adamantly opposed to this bill in its current form.
And that's the one that passed the Senate. Now, when are they going to take this up to the Assembly? Do you have any idea?
I most recently heard that they couldn't do it in the Assembly until January 20th, February 20th. So I think sometime next week it should be going through the Assembly.
Do you think there's any way to actually stop this wetland bill?
We tried. I don't know at this point if there is any way to stop it. It seems like the environmental champions that are able to pull their weight in our legislature right now are primarily in the Senate just because of the way that the votes go. I don't think that we could get a majority vote to stop this bill in the Assembly.
What's the next step then? Once the bill is passed, what's something people can do to protect the wetlands around them?
That is a great question. The wetland permitting process always includes a public comment, an ability to comment by the public. And so if a project is proposed in your area that will have impacts on wetlands, you can pay attention to what the permit notices are, and you can comment through public comments on any permit in your area that will have impacts to wetlands. And I think at this point that's the only way that the public is able to have a voice in this process.
And if people want more information or where they can help out or anything, where can they go to?
Well, if you want more information on this bill or any of the environmental bills that are going through our legislature at the moment, you can visit Clean Wisconsin's website, which is cleanwisconsin.org. You can follow us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter.
All right. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on. We will get more time with you in the next couple of weeks as these things unfold, and we'll see where everything goes, including the mining bill that seems to be stalled in the Senate, which is really good news. So thank you so much, and keep up the fight down there for the environment, and or up there, I should say. I'm down here, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thanks. Have a great day now.
You as well. Bye.
Thanks. That was Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin. We were talking about the wetland bill that was just passed in the Senate at, you know, midnight. That when I played that whole thing with Fitzgerald, says he wants to talk about the bill at 12:01 and reconvene at that point, it was the wetlands bill that they were talking about. Well, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today, and thank you for holding on and letting us work out our technical difficulties. These things do occur from time to time, and as someone even pointed out in the chat room, that it happens to the big boys, too. So thank you so much for holding on with us. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for his work on the show this week and for stepping in for me until we could figure out how things were working on my end. You can listen to the show at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can download the show from iTunes. You can also listen to the show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones and iPhones. Go to the, if you're an Android, go to the Android store, the iPhone. I'm assuming there's some sort of an iStore there. Look up Sarah Schultz Show. It's a free app. You can listen to all the archive shows. As soon as the show is done, it goes archive. You can listen to it in 5 minutes if it's on. You didn't catch the whole thing. Now, we're on Saturdays. You can listen to us Saturdays at 6 p.m. on WIDE 99.1 FM in Madison. On Tuesdays at 1 p.m. to WHYS 96.3 LPFM in Eau Claire. And on Sundays at 8 a.m. to WFAQ 92.9 LPFM in Mequonico, Waukesha. Remember, Wisconsin, forward, together forward. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.